Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.
It is 4:08 on a cloudy, rainy, drizzly. Well, at least your drive home should be more pleasant than my drive was to Coon Rapids this morning. My God, let me tell you, if you are driving a pickup truck or a dump truck, you do not care that Jason in his little sedan is taking it slow, because I'm worried that I'm going to fishtail all over the place. It was absolute bedlam out there on the roads this morning. Hopefully your drive home will be better for sure. 4:09, we are talking media as we do on Wednesdays. Jason talks to the media is what we call this segment. And today we have Charlie Ryback, the co-founder of Southwest Voices, is with us. Charlie, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
We were just talking about downtown Minneapolis, because you were in a room where you guys were discussing. It was a bunch of like this work group, right?
Yeah.
It's downtown. Your paper focuses, and I don't, do we even call it a paper? Your
publication.
Yeah. It's hard to know what we call the online digital news services now, because online news sites sounds a little like, is it just like a guy in a basement? Like,
I go with local news organization, but that feels a little organizational. Right. I don't know.
I know.
I don't have many answers for you, unfortunately.
Well, it's called Southwest Voices. The website is southwestvoices.news. And tell me how you sort of stepped into a void that was created with really neighborhood news, localized news coverage.
Definitely. So I grew up in Southwest Minneapolis. I love it there.
People might know your last name.
Yes, they might know my last name. I actually used to deliver the Southwest Journal. So
really?
I'd always been a fan on rollerblades. I wish I had video. The Southwest Journal went down, and I've just really been into the idea of local news for a long time. It's just one of the few remaining things that can bind us together. You know, we're all so split up, and I think local news can bring us back together. And so when they went down, I got together with a couple folks. My co-founder, Andrew Haig, has a really deep background in local news stuff, and we came up with this idea for starting Southwest Voices. We looked at a bunch of models and thought digital publication was the easiest way to do it, and we launched back in October 2021.
How do you define your coverage area?
Okay, so very broadly, 394 is our northern border. 35W is our eastern border. The southern border of the city is our southern border, and the western border of the city is our western border. So basically, like Bryn Mawr, Loring Park, all the way down the freeway, all the way down into the corner of the city.
And you have full-time reporters or freelance reporters, or how did you set up the staffing model?
So we have a full-time editor, Melody Hoffman. She's full-time. Andrew and I both work on this and work on a couple other things just to pay the bills. And then we have a whole bunch of sort of freelance reporters on top of that, and a woman named Vasiliki, who runs our advertising program.
And the advertising program is something that sort of has gone to a new level. Just this week, you guys announced kind of a new approach that's really bringing together, in a way, a lot of smaller, I don't know if they're hyper-local will be a way, but more niche-type news organizations.
Yeah, definitely. So Twin Cities Media Group emerged from a bunch of conversations we had. You know, initially it was sort of was talking to Jim Norton from Heavy Table, and we just said, you know, it'd be great if we could work together. And we pulled in a bunch of folks and ended up with a great group that's Heavy Table, Racket, North News, who covers the north side, does a great job, KRSM, and New Prensa. And basically, it's a combination of hyper-local folks, people that have a niche such as food or neighborhoods, and Racket, who's just generally incredibly cool.
Yeah, I think that's their ethos.
Yeah, it's they're good at it.
cooler than the rest of you.
Yes,
certainly.
Yes.
Yeah, and Racket is a bunch of City Pages people who kind of founded and started their own site, which is really fun. Twin Cities Media Group, and the idea is because the economics of news, and I don't know how much like the listener here cares about this, but I think they should, because we're seeing what the result of some of the challenges of the economics of news can be. The Pioneer Press, which has terrific journalists who still remain, but it's a shell of what it was you know, 20 years ago when I moved here, and it was a thick newspaper that was beating the crap out of the Strib sometimes for scoops.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, they have
St. great... St. Cloud? They have no local reporters at the St. Cloud News now.
And the issue is, you know, there are big companies that are making money off of a lot of these papers still. And, you know, there's the elephant in the room is sort of Facebook and Google, who just take a ton of advertising dollars. And as a local publication, it's hard. You know, if people have to do a one-off ad buy with you, it's difficult. So we kind of figured banding together, you know, we have a pretty good ad offering, we think. We have a bunch of great different publications you can reach that cover different audiences. And I think putting it all in one place is going to make it easy for advertisers to start to buy. And, you know, their dollars can actually stay in the local community.
Charlie Ryback is the founder of Southwest Voices. Do you find that when it comes to advertising, because that is your model, right?
Yeah.
It's
well,
free,
yeah. So it's free.
But.
Yes, free but. free to read. We have a daily newsletter that goes out. It has ads in it. We have paying members who pay to support our work, kind of like public radio has members.
Right.
Pay to support our work. And
do
that's
they get anything for being a member?
Yeah, so you get actually into our exclusive text line where you can text us for hand-picked recommendations, which is kind of fun, and then some cool benefits to local businesses in the area as
Got
well.
It. Yeah. Nice.
Yeah.
It's tricky to figure it out because people, especially generationally, a younger generation has been raised, I think, largely because of Facebook and Google, that you can get this stuff for free anywhere.
Yeah.
Information
yeah.
should be free, which I get that in theory, but like you got to pay somebody to do this work.
Yes. Yes. And if I could just... The one thing I will say is, like, if you love a news organization, please pay for it. If that is us, great. If it's a Star Tribune, whatever. If it's Racket, you know, whoever it may be, like, just please put your money where you want to see more journalism. And for businesses, you know, I know Facebook ads and YouTube ads and stuff are easy, but that money goes to Mark Zuckerberg's fifth boat. And if you spend money with local publishers, you know, that money stays in the community. And we share restaurants, we share small business news. And, like, you can create a really cool ecosystem around this, but it takes everybody kind of pitching in to fund it.
Charlie Ryback is the founder of Southwest Voices and part of the Twin Cities Media Group, this consortium of six different independent local publishers, broadcasters. When you talk to advertisers, why are they going on Facebook?
I mean, I think it's easy. You know, it's easy.
You can just sell.
You can set it up yourself. You can spend as much money as you want, and you can reach a ton of different people. The thing that I will say is that, and I put ads on Facebook for a big chunk of my career. My background was in digital marketing. That those placements and those ad placements are just nowhere near what you can get from a local news site. You know, you're on the top of Racket. You have KRSM reading off your ads on the radio. You know, you're on the top of our newsletter, which gets a 70% open rate from a bunch of people in Southwest Minneapolis every morning. There is not a product that Facebook or YouTube yeah. sell that's that good. And I think that's where the differentiator comes in. And that's a thing that I think marketers need to start just catch up and get up to speed.
Yeah. We face this, of course, as well, right here at WCCO. Like, it was something new for me to learn going from TV, where I had, you know, nothing to do with the sales side of the business.
Right.
And over here, where I'm not a journalist, which is weird to be like, I was a journalist 6 months ago, and now I'm a talk show guy.
Yeah.
But I'm more involved with clients and relationships. And you really do have to explain, like, look, I don't have all the metrics that you're going to get from Facebook, but ultimately judge me on, like, does this help your business? Does
yes.
this improve your brand position? Like, do you want a million data points from your Facebook ad that you ran yourself?
Right.
Or do you want someone to come into your business and buy something? Like, what are you looking for?
Yes, exactly. And I think that's the biggest thing. And, you know, for somebody like you, you know, you share stuff. You have a massive local audience of people that follow you already. So, you know, people that spend money with you and with your show, you've already gathered all those people there. So Facebook can go find them, but you've already got them. And, like, you know, we have a couple thousand people in Southwest Minneapolis who are opening this thing every day.
Yeah.
They're already there. Like, if you run a restaurant around there, there's not really a better place that you can go to spend your money.
Well, I want to ask you about kind of some of the coverage and things you've done in Southwest Voices and what maybe your favorite restaurants in that part of town, too. So we'll talk about that. Charlie Ryback is our guest. Southwest Voices is the site. Southwestvoices.news if you want to check it out. 4:17, back with more in just a minute here on Drive Time with DeRussia. 4:22, Drive Time with DeRussia here on CCO. Our guest is Charlie Ryback. So when RT was the mayor, mm-hmm. how old were you?
Elected when I was 12, left when I was 24.
So was it strange, like, to kind of grow up in that environment?
That is the most common question I get, and it's the one I'm completely unable to answer because I don't know the version of my life where he wasn't. So it was normal to me, but probably
people ask
weird.
My kids the same thing, the same question. Like, I don't know.
Totally. I mean, we had a bunch of really moments looking back that were amazing, but in a very unusual way. You know, there were dinners we would go to where there would be – I was 12, and there would be – 200 Somali people in a room and me and the rest of my family. And that was amazing. And like getting exposure to that as a 12-year-old is incredible.
Sure.
And so that's probably unusual, but it was great. You know, I loved it.
Yeah, that is great. Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. Yeah. It's, I imagine like anything, like, you know, Chad talks about being Sid Hartman's kid and that it opens doors for you, but it also like shackles you with expectations that depending where you are in life, like maybe you want those expectations, maybe you don't.
Yeah, yeah. No, definitely. I mean, I left for about a decade, which I think was great because it enabled me to just sort of like have an anonymous last name for a bit. And then coming back, you know, a lot of people obviously still know who he is, but some people don't. And so it's a good little mix of being able to sort of carve out your own identity.
I suppose so. Like, he's been out of office now for, it's been a couple of mayors. So
several years. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. All right. Charlie Ryback is here in Jason Talks the Media. He's the founder of Southwest Voices, southwestvoices.news. We're talking about kind of a new resurgence in a smaller neighborhood news. And some of your favorite stories that you guys have covered, what are some of the ones that pop up?
Man, you know, we have this great schools reporter named Melissa Whitler, and she's written a series of pieces just on the budget of Minneapolis public school system. And, you know, she was writing these back 6, 7, 8 months before the strike happened and basically said, hey, guys, this is where things are headed. This is going to happen. And I don't think a ton of people noticed it at the time. I know I was pretty skeptical of it, but she'd been watching the meeting. So she knew.
She knew. Yeah.
You know, we had one by Jiahong Pan, who wrote a piece about this landlord who had just stopped keeping up his buildings, basically. And then one of them over on Lyndale, 2312 Lyndale, burned down. And it was weeks after he had written this piece. And it was great because it felt like that's why local news matters, is you're there to provide the context for when something happens.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that story on the landlord was truly incredible, because then when the fire happened and all this, you had all this rich reporting about the history, which was something that, you know, if the Star Tribune had published, I don't know if it would have been, I think it would have been great, but I don't know if it would have been widely of interest to people until the fire happened.
Right, right. And it's just you can operate at a level that it is impossible to operate at if you're a larger media organization. I think, you know, I am a big fan of a ton of reporters at the Strib. They do great work, but you can't really focus in on this fire at this one building before it happens, right? And then after it happens, you come in and, you know, I think really looking honestly at a lot of the national coverage of 2020 and the murder of George Floyd and everything that happened after that, a lot of that, I thought they just got the story so wrong that feeling like the importance of this to like, we've got to get in there and we've got to tell, you know, people of Minneapolis need to be able to tell their own story, basically.
How do you think they got the reporting after George Floyd was skewed or wrong or focused on the wrong topics?
I mean, a lot of it was just so simple. It was so narrative driven. It was so, I've been here for 3 days and I know this, I know everything about this place that you can't possibly, you know, you couldn't really understand George Floyd without understanding Jamar Clark, for example. And that was something that was completely missing from the national news. And, you know, it's just really felt like that was a big part of just trying to understand what we were all going through.
Yeah, it's true. When you come in from out of town, sometimes you have the benefit where, because you don't have relationships, you also don't feel like you can't be as hard on someone because you might see them at dinner. But the reality is, I think most of our local journalists don't really worry about that anyway. Mm-hmm. But you're right, the idea of this certainty that, like, that, you know, you read the New York Times, it sounds like a pronouncement is being handed down.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
It does make you read some of the stuff more skeptically now when you're like, okay, we went through it. We lived through it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And nobody's worse than cable news, but we can save that for another day.
quote unquote news, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, no doubt. Charlie Ryback, Southwest Voices. You also poll your audience.
Yeah.
And I think that's really, I love it. You certainly have access because of the newsletter, so you know who the people are. But you ask them, what do you want us to cover in the city elections? Because obviously city council elections are going to be a big issue for you guys.
Yeah.
And people said public safety, housing, transit, public works are the top issues.
Yes. Yes. Those were the big four. I mean, it's interesting, right? Because a lot of the public safety people want that means, oh, I want you to cover more crime. A lot of the people, we want you to cover more police reform. The public works thing, I think, was especially large because of the general state of the streets at the moment.
Sure.
And then the housing stuff, you know, a lot of people want a lot more housing. I think we need a lot more housing. A lot of people want you to cover homelessness. So there's a bunch of stuff to unpack in there. But that was those were really the four that kind of jumped out.
Having themes, does that change the way that you might assign out? I mean, I think part of the way the media works that people who want to blame the media for everything don't really understand is I think the biggest source of bias is not in the reporters or the actual story. It's what you choose to cover and what you choose not to cover. That's where the real kind of what you decide is important. That's sort of that's why I think it's so interesting that you asked your readers, like, what do you guys care about?
Right, right. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, we read a lot of news. We live there. We could come up with stuff that seems interesting and important, but why not just ask people and see what they say? It seems like the easiest way to do it, honestly.
Right.
So,
but
and,
your point is correct that, like, when people say public safety, it means a lot of different things.
Yeah, a lot.
I do think that people – I started the show today talking about how I think, in general, there's been an interpretation that because the Republicans got their butts whipped so badly in the election, it was a message of saying, no, the voters care about these other things that Democrats were talking about. And I don't know that I agree with that. I think the voters said, well, we just don't trust the Republican solutions and we don't trust them on abortion. So so we dismiss them. And now I think, you know, hopefully we'll see some action on reforming police, on reforming what happens when we arrest people, like to try to turn their lives around.
Right, right.
But also, like, some people need to be locked up.
Yeah.
I wish we had a better solution than that, but some people need to be locked up. It's
I think on that topic, you know, there was all this common sense stuff that just got stuck. Like there was catalytic converter theft legislation. There was just we just didn't pass anything for a couple of years. And now it's happening. And I'm glad to see some action and people can decide on that on their own.
Right. Favorite things in South Minneapolis. The restaurant scene there is bananas.
Yeah.
Like, what are some of your favorites?
Totally. This is an incredibly loaded question. So I'm going to pick a corner. The corner of 38th and Nicollet has seven places that I love. Petit Leon, maybe my favorite meal in the city. E Bagnoli is incredible. Incredible fried chicken. Belluto, I think, probably has the best pizza in the city. Don't get mad at me, everybody else. It's just really good. Their empanadas are great. Young Man is this place run by this amazing couple that cook in there with their kid every day that I think is like the most underrated restaurant in the city because they're just cooking all the time and it's right there. Nighthawks has a great Reuben. That corner, I think, I would argue, is the best food corner in the city. And that's what I'm going to go with, which is kind of a cop-out, and I apologize for that.
It's a solid answer, though.
Yeah.
It's a great – I've never been to Young Man.
Oh, you have to go to
Young
Man.
I've been to all of those other things at that corner because it's such a great
Everybody should go to Young Man. It's just the best people in the world run that place.
And that is part of the beauty of doing a hyper-local site like Charlie Ryback's Southwest Voices because you do get to know those people.
Yeah.
It's cool. And you live there, too.
Yeah. Yeah, when I look outside, I always say when I look outside my house, I see Southwest Minneapolis, and it makes it much easier to cover that way.
It's cool. Charlie, thanks for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
This was really fun. 4:31, we'll take a break. We will come back, and we'll talk with John Choi. Big backlog when it comes to running DNA tests. Hard to make a dent on crime if you can't process the evidence. So we'll talk to John Choi in just a minute here on Drive Time with Duresh.
Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
I think a lot of us have a CSI or FBI, whatever CBS crime procedural show you're watching, idea of how evidence is processed and how quickly it's done. And this week, law enforcement officials from all over Minnesota met in the state capitol to say not only is the processing of DNA evidence in this state not happening in 60 minutes or in an hour, like 2 hours or 3 hours like you would see on TV, but it's not even happening in 30 days. John Choi is the Ramsey County attorney. He joins us on the John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. John, nice to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me on your show, Jason.
3,800 cases or so is the backlog of DNA evidence to be processed by the state right now. Is it really that bad?
Yeah, I mean, that's a huge backlog. And of course, you know, we've had an uptick in violent crime, and we need to investigate those cases and then bring them into the justice system. But of course, we got to prove these cases beyond a reasonable doubt. And so with this backlog, what happens is that the investigators get stalled because, for instance, if it's somebody who is ineligible to possess a handgun, but they weren't necessarily caught with the handgun, maybe the handgun underneath the car seat, we need to have evidence that would prove that they actually touched or possessed that particular handgun. And as we got more of these cases, but just other cases too, where, you know, there's an alleged shooter, but we need to get more corroborating evidence, the investigators can't even submit it to our office to have us make a decision on it. And then what we've also found is that it has implications on our cases as we are trying to, as they're managing their backlog, we want to get these cases tried and moving along in the system, but the BCA is so backlogged that they can't test everything, and we've got trials starting, you know, in a week or a month or whatever it might be. And so it's become a huge issue, and we need to make sure that we're doing right by the victims of our crimes. And so I decided here locally that, you know, I can't wait for the state. I'm going to just go ahead and fund this myself because this is a big deal. And then at the same time, and I want to credit Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan for their budget proposal that puts in funding that we could realize a vision of getting back to a 30-day turnaround time. You know, right now the turnaround time, the average is like 142 days. And for some of these cases, I mean, it's been like a year to get the forensic analysis back. So this bill that will be at the legislature to fund the forensic laboratory at the BCA is a huge deal, and hopefully your listeners can talk to their legislators about just supporting the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension and their needs around the forensic lab.
John Choi is the Ramsey County attorney. How much of this backlog are these cases where someone is under arrest and in jail, or is it a case where the arrest hasn't even happened because the evidence isn't processed yet, or what are we looking at?
It's a combination. There are a number of people who haven't even been arrested because we're still developing that investigation. There are some people, and this is probably the cases involving where there's a pending trial, right? They're in custody. They have not yet been convicted. And having more clarity about when we get these tests back can speed up the process to get to either a jury trial or some sort of plea negotiation that would happen in the justice system.
The head of the BCA, Drew Evans, had said there are a number of reasons for this. Some is that violent crime and gun-related crime is way up.
Mm-hmm.
Some is also that victims and witnesses aren't cooperating as much. So the importance of having that forensic evidence is higher than ever before. Has that been your experience?
Yeah, that's another really, really important issue, because I mean, if the victims and the witnesses will not cooperate with the police or with their prosecutions, we've got to figure out other ways to prove that case against the perpetrator. We might have a suspect. But if we can't get the best evidence, which would be the person that got shot, and we have to recognize, too, and reckon with the fact that people who are getting shot are not telling us who shot them because they are fearful that they're going to be retaliated against.
Right.
The most important thing is we got to catch the people that are doing the shootings, right? And then we got to hold them accountable, because none of this is going to stop unless we can do that. And so one of the things, too, we called out yesterday is our clearance rates on non-fatal shootings. You know, in St. Paul, we do a great job on the homicides. If someone's dead and been killed, we have like a 87% clearance rate, which probably leads the nation. And that's an amazing statistic, because a lot of communities with tall buildings, you know, they're like under 50%, well under 50%. But on the non-fatal shootings, we have a clearance rate of only about 35%, and we need to improve that.
Yeah, it's though, you know, John, I'm so glad you brought that up because this is something I think about a lot. Like, as a public, we get rightly so transfixed by a murder. But when I think about the safety of our Twin Cities, it's the gunshots fired. It's somebody getting shot in the leg. It's carjackings. It's a, I mean, most of us, you know, thank God, are never going to be faced with the chance that we're going to be murdered. It's just the reality. Like, almost all murders are between people who know each other or have some sort of relationship. True. So it's just not that I'm saying we shouldn't worry about murder, but like, we also shouldn't feel real great about the fact that all these other crimes that we don't have the resources to get those solved.
Right. And the shootings won't stop until we actually catch the suspects. That's the most important thing. Mm. If they're not being caught, there's a feeling that they can continue to do this.
Yeah. Oh, and John, I'm sure you hear from victims. John Choi, the Ramsey County attorney with us on CCO. The frustration there must be if you're a victim who is cooperating or victim's family, that the evidence is there. You're just in the queue. I'm sure the BCA, those forensic scientists are frustrated, too. Do we just need more people or they need more budget? What's the need?
I think that we have to be really thoughtful about how we deploy, but we certainly need more people. There's no doubt about that. And that's what the $6.1 million in 2024 and $5.1 in the following year will fund. But they're also wanting to fund like a facility down in Mankato to help process other types of DNA evidence, like the latent fingerprints. I think they should also be thinking about utilizing private labs. I mean, I think they should be thinking about the whole spectrum. Because there are serious cases, right? And then there are some that are not so serious, but still we need to have accountability there. So if we're talking about like an auto theft, we have lots of pending cases, but they can't even get to those auto theft cases because there's the violent cases that are above it.
John Choi is with us. John, I want to ask you about, you know, when you mentioned the fear of retaliation, it certainly makes me think of gangs. And there was a time 20 years ago when we talked about gangs in our cities more often. And I feel like today there's not a lot of conversation about it, maybe because you don't have the Bloods and Crips and you don't have gang colors and it's just a different gang environment. But I'm concerned. I mean, you're much closer to this than I am as an observer, but with the stabbing at Harding High School, the retaliation at the Celebration of Life, I mean, are we on the edge of a dangerous gang escalation in St. Paul in Ramsey County?
Well, they're not like gangs as we once knew them back in the 90s, but they're groups of small people, and they change a lot, you know, the names and the affiliations. But a lot of this is happening around social media. And I really believe that we've got to bring everything to the table. You know, it's not just the policing and the law enforcement piece of it, but it's also the preventive piece, the direct intervention. We know a lot of the kids right now who are involved in this retaliatory conversation. And, you know, like on Friday at what happened at the Wellstone Rec Center, that was probably one of the most predictable things that, I mean, you knew something like that could happen.
Yeah.
But there were people. There were people in our community. There was law enforcement and probation officials trying to do everything that they could to get these young people not to go. But they still went. And so that's the sad part of it. I feel like in many ways, like I kind of feel like maybe how their parents might feel, that they're losing control of our young people. And we've got to figure this out. But I do know this, is that the path forward and the way that we're going to get through all of this is that everybody working together, not focusing on blaming one another for the problem, understanding the broader perspective, and then really just get to work and pulling in the same direction. Sometimes I have felt around our strategies around violence over the course of the last 4 or 5 years, like everybody's pulling in different directions. And we had a really good meeting today where everybody got together at the law enforcement center and started just talking about some of these kids and the strategies that everybody's working on. And getting to that place where we're pulling together, that's the key. But it's also really scary right now because a lot of this stuff also spills into the schools. And think about all those kids in our schools who are there to learn. I mean, school has to be a sacred place. And so we need to come up with some better solutions. And so I know people are working on that. I think people got the message that we have to just collaborate and work together. The blame game has to be over in Ramsey County, and we need to work on solutions.
John Choi, I appreciate you being with us. John, also like me, a Marquette University alum. Have you been following?
Number six in the nation, buddy.
That's right. I was going to ask if you've been following. I knew the answer.
Right.
Very good. The Golden Eagle. You were a Warrior, I think. You graduated.
I was a Warrior, right?
I'm only
1992.
I'm only one part Warrior. They changed the name to Golden Eagles in the middle. You people think we were all that. Wokeness was just invented. Marquette was on it. We were ahead of the curve.
Right.
John Choi, nice to visit with you. Thanks for being on.
Yeah. Take care, Jason. Bye.
4:48 on News Talk 830 WCCO. Love to have you check out our podcast. We take every hour of this show and we put it up on a podcast. So it's great if you're working out at the gym or you have a long commute. You can listen to a whole hour. We also put up each individual segment. So today, for example, if you want to listen back to John Choi, the Ramsey County attorney, or maybe you want to hear about my thoughts on a story in the news today, a woman brutally beaten on a light rail train platform in Minneapolis. Will this finally get a focus on cutting down on the nonsense and the crime in our transit system? Check that out on the podcast as well. CBS News is coming up, then Laura Oakes, then D-Rush Hour News headlines. Lots of fun ahead in our next hour here on Drive Time with D-Rush.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.